Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for October's Emergency and Critical Care Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, RCVS Recognised Specialist in Emergency and Critical Care Medicine, Lindsay Kellett-Gregory. Thank you, Lindsay. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hey, thank you very much for the introduction. And for the next hour, we're going to be talking about how we approach the thoracic trauma patient. So hopefully at the end of this hour, what we'll have got out of this is a basic approach to these patients that could otherwise be a big sort of stress and anxiety to everybody in the practice. We're going to talk through things that we can do to stabilize them, whether we know what's wrong with them at that point in time or not, things that we can do to help. And then really focus most of this talk on common injuries that they sustain, how we get to that diagnosis, and then how we manage them. In the interest of time today, we're not really going to be able to discuss a lot of specifics of the surgical management in great detail, but we'll certainly flag up when surgery is indicated and any particular things of note to cover there. So just to make sure we're on the same page, if we're talking about thoracic trauma, what are we actually talking about? Well, essentially we divide it up either into blunt trauma or penetrating trauma. And I think I'm more used to seeing blunt trauma, so usually the hit by car, hit by bike, hit by train, hit by whatever object that they seem to have intercepted. But we can also get stepped on patients, and we see high-rise syndrome patients. So quite a few different causes of blunt trauma in itself. And the second category is our penetrating injuries, so things like our bite wounds, our malicious woundings, and then just the accidental injuries, so the poor dog seen here was having a nice walk in the woods and then seems to have come home with something extra. So those sort of accidental impalements that we do see from time to time. So lots of different causes. Some of which the blunt trauma may not look that bad on the outside to start with. Similarly with the penetrating wounds as well, we often just don't know what's going on inside. And the truth is we can see a whole host of injuries internally after any kind of thoracic trauma. I've made this list here, but it's by no means an exclusive list, but flags up some of the more common and potentially more serious injuries that we see. And I think with these sorts of diseases or disorders on the list, we need some kind of approach as to how we're going to deal with this. Otherwise, you could understand a natural tendency to panic with these sorts of conditions in front of us. I just want to kind of flag up the fact that it may not look that bad to start with, but for certainly the two things that I've flagged here, the diaphragmatic rupture and the chylothorax examples, we may not see things as bad to start with as they could potentially get later. So we may find that these we diagnose a few days down the line, especially in the case of diaphragmatic injuries. If there's no organs displaced, we may not see signs to start with. And chylothorax may be a delayed injury where we see the presenting signs a few weeks after the trauma. So even if we get over the first few days, it's not necessarily all sorted. And I've definitely been caught out with these patients before, and often what we see on the outside of these trauma patients can be the tip of the iceberg. So this was a young German shepherd who presented to our clinic and came in for a small wound on the side of the chest, which we clipped and cleaned. Small wound, about a centimetre, but directly over the chest, so we're a little bit concerned. Took some x-rays, we found a pneumothorax and thought we should probably investigate what this is. And I don't know if it's possible to see the surgical picture is a little bit on the dark side, but I don't know if you can appreciate inside the thorax there's actually a corresponding hole where that initial wound was. And lo and behold, when we had a look round to see if there was any other injuries, this was the area of lung immediately underneath that penetrating wound, and this would turn out to be a stab wound, needed a lung lobectomy to remove this damaged part of lung. So the outside didn't look that bad, turned out this dog needed some fairly aggressive treatment before it made a full recovery. And so if we think about the patients that we might see in our clinic, so if we use Lucky as an example, a young dog hit by a car about an hour before seeing us, didn't actually witness the accident itself, but the dog's presented to us with respiratory distress. And I think this is maybe more typical of the sort of patients that we'll see. And so what do we do? what we need to think about, especially when we're working under pressure and stress, is to have a way of approaching these cases so we can rapidly get them sorted. And this is the way that I would approach any emergency patient, but is certainly applicable to our thoracic trauma guys. So we're triaging them just like you would do if you or I went into a human A&E. And what we're trying to do is to figure out if there's any life-threatening problems and try and sort out our workload in terms of prioritizing who needs to be seen first. And the way that we go about doing that is we go through our ABCs, we get a capsule history, and a major body systems assessment, which is basically a very streamlined, efficient clinical exam to look for big problems on the horizon. And so if we briefly go through each of these in turn, the ABCs is something we probably don't think about because it's so innate to our practice. So we're essentially, this is a life check. So does the patient have a patent airway? Is it making useful breathing efforts? And is there a heartbeat with pulses? And I think each of us, if the patient fails any of these tests, it's time for CPR, which is a subject of another webinar. Assuming that we've established that they're still alive at this point, then we're really going to get into what's been happening and how badly have they been affected. And this is where we take our capsule history next. So essentially, I want to know from these owners, probably in 30 seconds or less, why they're here today. So I want the signalment, why are they here? And is there anything significant I need to know about their current medical history that might impact what I do? Specifically for a trauma patient, there are other questions that I'll want to know the answers to fairly early on. And that's largely to try and get a heads up as to the most likely injuries that I'm going to be finding. So specifically for a trauma patient, I'm thinking about, has there been any loss of consciousness in terms of could there be any traumatic brain injury that I should be aware of? The site of any impact, it's not to say that there couldn't be injuries all over the patient, but if I know that the site of impact has predominantly been the chest, then that's going to be where I'm most worried about injuries happening. The speed of impact, and I've been misled by this before, assuming that fast collisions are going to cause more damage than the sort of the slow rollover type injuries. But actually, I think we tend to see serious injuries with both. And actually, with the slow rollovers, it's quite common because there's sustained pressure on the patient that we can get rupture of things like the diaphragm, the bladder, and so on, more so than with a fast impact that might be more of a glancing blow. So the speed, if it's known, can be useful. Is the patient ambulatory? Is there likely to be a significant spinal cord injury? And has the patient urinated in terms of could there be a urinary problem? But also, when can I next expect the patient to void normally, assuming everything's intact? So a few questions just to get a heads up, so I'm hopefully one step ahead. And then the crux of this triage, this sorting, is the major body systems assessment. And whilst this little cartoon shows there's lots of organs that we could worry about, if our patient is going to die in the near future, ultimately that's going to happen because one of these three body systems, either heart, brain, or lungs, is going to have failed. And as such, in any emergency patient, certainly in a trauma patient, if we just focus our initial assessments on these three systems and do a basic screen and ask ourselves, is there anything that's going to kill our patient first? And the nice thing about this is that for each of those three systems, the heart, brain, and lungs, the things that we look for in our physical exam is very easily obtained, straightforward information. It's just a question of grouping it into these organ systems to allow for that sort of interpretation. And so I've put all three up here for reference today. Essentially, cardiovascularly, we're looking for evidence of shock. In the nervous system, we're looking for evidence of brain injury or spinal cord injury in these trauma patients. And then in our respiratory system, we're really looking for anything that could have been injured in the trauma the patient sustained. I did want to mention at this point that we're saying that we're keeping calm, we're just doing this streamlined clinical exam, but it's easy to be distracted. And I've been certainly guilty of this myself. When something comes in that makes a good photo opportunity, the tendency is to get distracted by the blood and the gore. And if we're able to keep calm ourselves, we can do this focused evaluation, actually find out what's the life-threatening problem. And it may well not be the most gory or the most visually a spectacular injury that we see. So the tendency is to get distracted. We have to be quite disciplined not to do that, and then just make sure that we're thorough and we look very closely for anything that could be wrong. Moving on to the respiratory system, specifically in our trauma patients, I put down a list here of things that I would consider to be red flags or things that really make me concerned and say I think there could be some significant thoracic traumas occurred to this patient. I think it makes sense if we've got any signs of dyspnea or respiratory distress, we're naturally going to assume that there's some disorder in the respiratory system and that warrants attention. But within that, if I have a patient with orthopnea, so for example, as we can see in the pictures here, we've got patients who are changing their body position to try and compensate for some respiratory distress. The dog in the top picture, you can see is really just doesn't look happy for one, but is up in sternal, has those elbows out, the neck extended, is really trying to do everything it can to minimize resistance to breathing, but still failing. And the cat in the bottom picture, we can see a laterally recumbent cat who's open mouth breathing. This cat's doing everything it can to try and aid its breathing unsuccessfully. So we do see differences between the species, but both of these patients simply increasing their respiratory rate isn't enough to account for whatever problem they've got, and as such I'm particularly worried about them. Similarly, if we see patients having to use extra muscles to try and breathe, so these are the patients we see with extra abdominal effort, abdominal push, anything that suggests that they're working harder than they would normally have to breathe is a concern. Cyanosis, where we get a significant proportion of deoxygenated hemoglobin, and subcutaneous emphysema typically represents the fact we've got something severely structurally wrong going on as a result of the trauma as well. And so what do we kind of go with that? We've got these red flags, but how do we start getting to the bottom of what the problem is? And actually, the physical exam can give us a whole host of information, which can really sometimes just actually provide a diagnosis just based by itself. So any sort of respiratory problem has to arrive from one of the few anatomic parts of the respiratory system, be that pleural space, lung, airways, etc. And depending on where these problems are arising from, these patients can have very very typical respiratory patterns or findings in auscultation that can clue us into the location of the problem. So if we work through these to sort of see where we can get the most information from our physical exam, with pleural space diseases, these are the patients that have a very short, shallow breathing pattern. Some might say it's restrictive, whereby they just don't have the functional lung left behind to do a nice full excursion. So it's a very short pattern we're seeing. And we're probably familiar with these patients when we auscult them. They have dull lung sounds. Dorsally in the case of air in the pleural space, ventrally in the case of fluid. And if it's a diaphragmatic rupture, as in this radiograph on the slide, we might actually hear abnormal gut sounds in an abnormal place. So if we have this sort of pattern, initially we're thinking pleural space disease, and we can think about our trauma differentials as a shortcut straight away. Similarly with pulmonary parenchymal disorder, so in a trauma patient, we're thinking about pulmonary contusions as one of our biggest differentials here. They don't necessarily have such a specific respiratory pattern, so it tends to be more mixed. They just look dyspneic or have respiratory distress. But when we auscult them, this is where we're finding that their lung sounds are particularly harsh for their degree of breathing effort. And we may strike lucky, we might hear crackles, which are very, very definitive for this type of problem. In some of the more severely affected patients, we might paradoxically have areas of the lung which really sound dull when we auscult them. And that can happen if we have, for example, really severe pulmonary contusions. We've just got several alveoli just absolutely full of blood, so there's nowhere moving in there or out of there at all. And they sound quieter than you'd expect, but typically we'll have crackles in other areas as well that will make us more comfortable. It's actually a pulmonary parenchymal disease that we're dealing with. On the left of the slide, I've put in the sort of characteristic breathing patterns we see with upper airway disorders, so things like our laryngeal paralysis or Boas dogs, or our lower airway diseases like our asthma cats. And I've put this in here. I think we can appreciate they're not common injuries that we see with thoracic trauma, but I've included them in case patients have these disorders concurrently, just so that we're not confusing them with trauma-relevant injuries. But I did want to mention the chest wall and diaphragm. We have a little video here of an affected dog. So what we're dealing with here is this was a dog who sustained some trauma actually to its chest wall. And what's happened is we can see as this dog breathes, normally you'd expect the whole chest wall to move as a whole. So as we breathe in, the whole chest wall moves out. As we breathe out, the whole chest wall moves in. And as we zoom in here, what we can see is the patient breathes in, and part of that chest wall is actually being sucked in at the time of inspiration. So we've got an abnormal chest wall movement. And that's probably the most specific thing that we're seeing with chest wall injuries in trauma, is just that abnormal movement. So we might have to look closely, might have to clip up the patient, but it will generally be there. And most of the time, it's very straightforward that pleural space patients breathe in a certain way, lung patients breathe in a certain way, but it starts to get a bit trickier in the trauma patient because multiple injuries are really quite common. And as such, it's not quite so straightforward, and it might the presence of multiple injuries might complicate how we interpret our physical exam findings. So this was a case that confused me. So this is a dog that we can see has some degree of pneumothorax, has some pulmonary contusions, and also has some rib fractures. And when I assessed this dog, the dog looked in respiratory distress, but when I ausculted the dog, the lung sounds were really quite normal, which was a surprise. I was expecting things to sound a whole lot worse. And what had actually happened in this case was that the presence of the pneumothorax, as we can see just on the side here, was creating some dull lung sounds. The pulmonary contusions over here were causing some harsh lung sounds, and between the two, they'd balanced each other out to make the patient sound abnormally normal. So I think probably what we can take from this is that it's important that we cross-reference our physical exam findings to the degree of respiratory distress, and a normal auscultation in an otherwise dyspneic patient might be an abnormality in itself. I wanted to put this subject into the respiratory look-alike, as it's called, because whilst we see respiratory signs quite commonly in our trauma patients, it might not be actual respiratory system pathology that's causing it. And certainly, of the things I've listed here, we can probably appreciate the average trauma patient may have one or several of these. So we know from ourselves, if we're painful, fearful, anxious, our respiratory rate is going to be higher. If our body's compensating for less oxygen being delivered, so with anemia or shock, again, the respiratory system will increase to compensate for that. And we can also see it from drug effects and in terms of compensating for other disorders. So I guess I wanted to make this point to say that just because there's some respiratory signs doesn't mean that there has to be a serious respiratory injury, and that it would be quite nice if it was one of these more readily treatable things in some cases, that we don't need to forget about them. And so with that said, what do we do to actually go about stabilizing these patients? Because at this point in time, we might have a bit of a heads up to say, we know there's been a trauma to the thorax, we're suspicious that there could be some contusions, but we don't know for sure exactly what we're dealing with. And so we're often making decisions to stabilize based on limited information. And how do we do that? Well, essentially, the crux of it comes down, the most important things is minimizing stress and providing oxygen. And the two need to be considered together, because when we're thinking about these patients, it makes sense to provide oxygen, but if our therapy is causing more stress, we can really upset the balance between oxygen delivery and oxygen consumption if this patient's fighting, trying to get away from our oxygen supply. So whatever we do with these patients, we should minimize stress. If we have quieter areas where we can take them to assess them, if we can manage our own stress and that of people around us, it can really help these patients' respiratory systems tremendously. And then in terms of how do we provide oxygen to a patient with respiratory signs, well, these are techniques that we've probably all used before. So we've got an example of some flow by oxygen and a mask oxygen if they're well tolerated. really quite handy for that initial assessment where we're maybe hands-on ausculting, really getting to grips with what the likely injuries are. But probably you're only going to provide about 30, maybe 40% of inspired oxygen at the most, and probably aren't a long-term solution in terms of having somebody standing there holding the oxygen the whole time, but quite a good initial means. For hands-off means of providing oxygen, we can think about using things like nasal prongs, as you can see on the picture on the left. So these are the prongs that they we get from the human hospital, so quite short, just fit solely inside the nostrils. And can work well if the patient is quiet and isn't bothered by them. We can put some local anaesthetic up the nose to try and aid that. But they don't tend to work terribly well if the patient's breathing through its mouth or panting. And I often find that they get displaced and I'm oxygenating an ear once I've turned my back on the patient. So if they work well, great. If not, then some patients just don't tolerate them so well. A slightly more solid way of providing nasal oxygen is the nasal cannulae that we can see on the dog on the right of the screen. And what we've got here is we've just got a couple of thin feeding tubes, so maybe three or five French tubes, really quite, they don't need to be big tubes at all. And we could use red rubber catheters as well. And what we've done here is just pre-measure our tube from the edge of the edge of the nostril up to the medial canthus of the eye. And then inserted this tube into the ventral meatus of the nose and sutured it to the dog and attached it to an oxygen supply at the back here. And this can be quite a nice way of providing oxygen for longer term as well and a hands-off means because the patient can just sit and just tolerant of that. It can provide up to sort of 60% oxygen, so can be really quite effective. But we do need a patient who's stable enough for the initial placement, so it may not be for everybody. And so we often think about, can we make some kind of oxygen tent? And there's all sorts of things that we can purchase or create. Just got a few examples here, which can be quite nice, but we just need to bear in mind that these are often dynamic patients who we're assessing or re-examining, and every time we open up these tents or cages, we're decreasing the oxygen in there. So can work well, can be a nice quiet environment that can add in with that minimizing stress that we mentioned, but equally it has its downsides. We need to think about what suits that individual patient best. And then the tricky question comes up to say, well, when is that not enough? When do we need to up the ante and be more aggressive? And that may involve actually taking the airway, intubating the patient and breathing for them. And just the still of this dog, we can probably appreciate this as a dog where we're thinking about that. And yes, it's an effective way of providing oxygen. We know that we're just a couple of steps from providing 100% oxygen, but it is an aggressive move since we do need to have some means of curing this patient to be able to then have it leave the practice in some way, hopefully better or sent elsewhere for overnight care as needed. And so we tend to reserve this step for patients with really severe respiratory distress. So they're looking tired, they look like they're about to respiratory arrest, or patients that just we've done what we can to stabilize them and they're not responding to therapy. We need to be more aggressive with diagnostics, but they're just not stable enough to tolerate it. Or we might think about this as a patient who just can't breathe or just has massive injuries that isn't compatible with life in the long term. So aside from oxygen therapy, what else can we do to stabilize patients? Well, I've put IV catheter placement here, and when I normally give my respiratory distress talks, I'm very much in the camp that I withhold IV catheter placement to start with because it doesn't necessarily change what we do and it can be a stressful factor. It can really cause some patients to decompensate if they're very, very fragile. But in a trauma patient, I'm a little bit more aggressive in terms of I like to have an IV catheter placed to start with for the reason that I can provide analgesia, sedation if needed, or an anesthesia in order to take an airway or provide emergency drugs. So as long as it's not stressing the patient unduly, I do tend to place IV, get IV access early on. And then one of the most important stabilizing techniques that that we have up our sleeve is the ability to do a thoracocentesis. And I'd say the indication for that procedure for me is if I have even a suspicion that I have some pleural space disease. So that might be based on breathing pattern, based on auscultation, as we've mentioned before. If I even the slightest suspicion, I will go ahead and do this procedure. And the nice thing about it is that it can be both diagnostic, so it can show me that I'm thinking along the right lines if I do get air or fluid or whatever I was expecting, but can really help stabilize these patients really very well. So it's quite an effective, efficient procedure to do. What I think it's a good thing to get in the habit of doing is after we've completed the thoracocentesis and let's say we've taken off some air in the case of a pneumothorax, is to make sure that we get our new assessment of that patient, a new baseline, just so we can look for any changes. If the condition deteriorates again, we know where we were at sort of time zero immediately after drainage. And we also need to think about the volume of air or fluid that we've removed from the chest, because if we read the textbooks, they say that you need to remove about 20 to 30 mils per kilo of air or fluid to make a significant improvement in respiratory function. So if we've taken off a small amount, we're happy that was all that there was in there to take, but the patient still has respiratory signs, then we can say that it's probably got multiple injuries as a result of its trauma going on. Other easy things that we can do to help stabilize, well, patient positioning is something that is really, really very important. And there's some really nice clinical studies that show that if simply moving a patient from lateral to sternal recumbency can massively improve its oxygenation, such it might take that patient from needing to be intubated and ventilated to just getting by with some flow by oxygen. So it really is a massive improvement. So if the patient will tolerate it, that's definitely an easy thing to do. If we have a patient with a confirmed diaphragmatic rupture, then positioning them such that we're trying to have gravity on our side to try and encourage those displaced organs back to their rightful place. So in a very severely affected patient, what we can do is actually lift that patient up underneath its forelimb such that it's in a vertical position, and a little gentle movement to try and encourage those organs back down into the abdominal cavity again. And for serious chest wall injuries, paradoxically, they can actually breathe a little bit more comfortably sometimes if we place them side down on the injured side, just so there's less movement of that chest wall. So it may depend on the patient, but there are all things that we can try. Something else that I tend to do up front and can really help stabilize patients or improve the situation is timely analgesia. And it's something that often is a cause for concern that they're unstable, but when do we provide analgesia? And I'm very much of the opinion that I'll be happy to give them analgesia even if they're markedly unstable, for the reason that we mentioned that pain can be a cause of a respiratory system lookalike. It might make our respiratory pattern look worse than it is. So I know if I've treated them for pain and their respiratory pattern's still abnormal, I know I need to go chasing some internal injury. We typically use drugs that are by nature cardiovascularly sparing. So I think if we have opioids, that would be preferable. And we're using lower doses that we can always repeat if we need to or add to later. So I feel like if I have a patient who I administer 0.1 mg per kg of methadone to and that causes its untimely demise, then there was probably something really quite severe going on anyway. And if I'm choosing a drug, as I said, opioids tend to be our preference. But I will avoid the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs just because at this stage I generally don't know about other injuries, especially in terms of kidney and other things too. So typically you're going the opioids early on to help stabilize them. And then again, it's outside the scope of this talk today, but it's important that we optimize those other major body systems we mentioned, so the cardiovascular and neurologic systems. And it's a bit of a balancing act, to be honest. I've got the radiograph down here of a dog with some really quite marked pulmonary contusions after a chest trauma. And this dog may well be in shock, is likely to need fluid therapy. But equally, those lungs aren't going to appreciate a ton of crystalloid fluids being dumped into them. So we need to strike that balance, but it's often a case of juggling act and prioritizing the body system that's most severely affected. So hopefully our patients are a little bit more stable and we're thinking about starting to confirm what's actually gone on and what of those injuries as this patient sustained. And I just wanted to repeat the point that we don't have to know exactly what's going on to provide those initial stabilizing measures. But there may be things that we can do to get a heads up without being too invasive. So it seems like we're using a lot of patient-side ultrasound at the moment, which can be used without causing a lot of stress or without having to move patients if we have a portable machine. So that might be quite a good diagnostic tool. And then assuming we can get them more stable, we can do further, more definitive imaging like our radiographs or similar to assess for other injuries. In terms of other diagnostics, typically our trauma patients have classically been healthy animals up until the point of trauma, so it's unlikely they'll have a whole host of other organ dysfunction, so in terms of needing to run blood work. But can be useful to get an initial PCB and total solids to get an indicator if there's any acute bleeding. And similarly get baseline renal values just in terms of could there be urinary tract trauma or trauma elsewhere in the body if there's been a significant accident. So I wanted to mention this this patient-side ultrasound a little bit more. And it's something that really has been one of the biggest changes, I would say, in our emergency practice in the last few years in my hospital. And it's this employment of what's called a TFAS scan, which stands for a thoracic-focused assessment with sonography for trauma. And what we're doing in this is we're looking at standardized sites on both sides of the chest, and we're using it as a screen to see if there's any air or fluid in the pleural space or if there's any pericardial effusion. And I certainly don't class my ultrasound skills as advanced. I don't think I'd spot an adrenal if it was labeled. But the nice thing about these scans is that they were actually designed or first came up in human medicine to be used by lay responders. So it's certainly within our skill set that we can adopt these on our patients without having to be expert imagers by any means. And so what we're doing with our TFAS scan is we're putting our ultrasound probe on five specific sites. So the first position, number one, is term the chest tube site, and we look at that on both sides of the chest, usually between the seventh and ninth intercostal space, where we're specifically looking there for the presence of pneumothorax, as we'll talk about in the next slide. And the other site's labelled number two. This is our pericardial chest site, so this is usually the intercostal space, sort of between ribs five and six, where we're looking for pleural effusion, where we're looking for pericardial effusion. And again, that's left and right chest. And the third site, we term our subxiphoid view. And basically, we're putting the probe on in that location, looking in a cranial direction with the depth adjusted such that we can see the pleural and pericardial spaces again as an extra check for effusion in those locations. So the nice thing about this is that we can perform this this conscious. It tends to be its patient side. We don't have to clip the patient to do this. And so it's quite non-invasive and usually very well tolerated. And what information can it tell us? Well, I think one of its biggest uses is to rule out whether or not there's a pneumothorax present. And sometimes, even with the best will in the world, it can be hard from our physical exam to tell, and the patient might not be stable enough for radiographs. And this TFAS scan can give us a really good indication if it's there or not. And so what we do is we use our chest tube site, so that's over our seventh to ninth intercostal spaces, if we're looking for air, over the least dependent area of the chest, and this can be done in sternal or lateral recumbency, depending on our patient's stability and comfort level. And so what we do is we put our ultrasound probe on the side of the chest, and what we're learning to recognize is the appearance of the ultrasound between those two ribs. So in the diagram I've got down here, we'd have our ultrasound probe on at the top of the chest here, and then these two lines here with the initials RS represent our ribs and the acoustic shadowing that we see underneath them. And what we're looking for is this this line connecting them. So it's it's a very dense line connecting the two ribs up. And that line's actually the pleural line. So it's where we've got the junction of our parietal pleura that normally lines the thorax and our visceral pleura that's normally lining our lung. And in a normal patient, those two areas of pleura should be completely opposed. There shouldn't be anything between them. So it should just be one line. And then as we watch this patient breathe, we should actually see a movement of that line together. It's a dynamic sign. It's impossible to sort of see from a single view, but it literally slides back and forth, as I'm sort of demonstrating with the arrow here. And the nice thing about looking for this normal movement is that if we see that movement, it means that those two layers of pleura are next to each other, which means definitively that there cannot be a pneumothorax. And so the presence of this glide sign is a normal finding and excludes a pneumothorax. If we put our ultrasound probe on and we keep the probe nice and still and we don't see that movement, then that is really suggestive that there's something between those two pleural lines, and as such that would be very suggestive of a pneumothorax, which would then maybe give us a bit more confidence or the idea to try a thoracocentesis to see if there is any air that we can get. And what we can also do is to get a sense as to if air is reforming or not. Again, this isn't a replacement for auscultation, but with practice, we can get used to putting the probe on different levels of the chest, so we can get an idea as to how full of air the chest may be and if the patient's conditioning is worsening over time. The other thing that we can do with our TFAS scan is to look for things that are called lung rockets or comet tails or beelines. Various terminology all means the same thing, but similar principle. We put the probe on the side of the chest in that chest tube site. Again, the figure we can see our ribs coming down. And what we're looking for here is that we see these hypoechoic lines that are reverberating down to our far field, starting at that pleural line that we mentioned in the previous slide. And again, these move with them. They oscillate like a pendulum as the patient breathes in and breathes out. And it can be normal to see a couple of them. But if we see a lot of these beelines, so you can appreciate in the still of the ultrasound here, there's a lot of these lines going in this orientation that will be moving with breathing in a dynamic field. And if we see a lot of those, or if we see them very close together, then in a trauma patient, it's incredibly suspicious of or diagnostic of pulmonary contusions until proven otherwise. So again, might be a heads up, easy information as to what might be going on. So I wanted to spend the rest of this talk talking about these specific conditions that we're working towards diagnosing and stabilizing as to how we definitively diagnose them and how we manage them. And I wanted to start with pneumothorax because it's certainly one of the commonest complications of trauma that we see. And in our high-rise cats, certainly definitely over half of them will have some degree of pneumothorax. We're probably familiar with the fact that it's caused by air leaking from the lung tissue or airways into the pleural space around the lungs. And radiographically, again, we're probably familiar with diagnosing this. So we can see in the radiographs here that both of them exhibit some elevation of the cardiac silhouette off the sternum. Both show, if we were to look at these in close detail, we'll see in these affected areas that there's an absence of lung markings in the periphery because the lungs have been collapsed. And I think the top radiograph shows really quite well that this marked atelectasis, you can actually sort of see the lung outlined and all squashed up because of that extra air taking up space. So radiographically, fairly easy to diagnose. What do we do once we've diagnosed a pneumothorax? Well, whether or not it's an open or closed trauma that's caused it really affects what we do. So if this is an open trauma, so let's say it's a penetrating wound, then if we see air in that space, it means that we're certainly concerned that there's been damage to the underlying lung, there's been a serious breach in that chest wall, and so we're thinking that that may well be a case for surgical exploration to assess what damage has been done and clean up any mess that's been created. If it's a closed pneumothorax, which is the more common scenario, then we're looking at doing our thoracocentesis or repeating it. And I'd say most of the time we get away with that. We tap the chest once or twice and that's the end of the pneumothorax, but there's always the odd one that's a bit more challenging, and we have to think about, do we need to place some kind of chest drain? And with that, there's no right answer, I would say, as to when it's appropriate to place a chest drain with pneumothorax, but some of the things that I would think about would be I have a three strikes rule. So if I've had to perform multiple chest taps within a short period of time due to recurrence of air formation, usually on the third time, I'll go ahead and place that chest drain. That said, it may well depend on what volume of air I'm retrieving. If I'm tapping them, if I had to tap them two or three times, but the amount of air I'm getting is decreasing each time, then that may be one I'll leave to sit for a bit longer. But generally speaking, multiple taps equals consider a chest drain. If I'm failing to achieve negative pressure when I do a thoracocentesis and I'm happy that it's not me, that it's I don't have some kind of leak in my system, then that's an indication for a drain. And if we do end up placing a drain, we need to think about, do we want to do intermittent drainage? So we're just intermittently hooking up a syringe to empty out the chest, or picking some kind of continuous drainage system. And it may well depend on what we have to hand or how mobile the patient is, can often come into this decision making as well. But what I would say is for intermittent drainage, whilst it may be tempting to grab the 60 mL syringe for a big dog just to empty out air nice and quickly, it may well be a good idea if we can to use maybe smaller 10 or 20 mL syringes just to minimise extra pressure we're applying on the injured lung that may otherwise open up a hole that was on the verge of sealing up. So just syringe size and amount of pressure that we're applying when we're draining is important. And if we have something that just is reforming continually or more so than is reasonable to manage with intermittent drainage, we might think about one of these continuous drainage machines or apparatus. And we can buy various machines that do this or various bits of kit. But in theory, you could, if you were feeling creative, you could make your own. So the basic principle is shown in the figure down here. So we'd have some source of negative pressure, so usually attached to some kind of suction producing machine at the end here. We'd have our patient's chest drain attached on the right side here, and essentially it's three chambers or three bottles, three columns, three cylinders, whatever you like. So the first is responsible as a fluid trap, so the chest drain, any fluid that we're draining out gets collected into negative pressure and drops down into the bottom of this container. The suction continues and any air that's been removed from the patient will come down here, and because it has to come up through this layer of liquid at the bottom of this particular type of drainage device, we can see bubbles, and the presence of bubbles means that we're still getting air out of the patient, so it can tell us if the patient still has a pneumothorax that's forming. And the final bottle over here is responsible for by means of the height of the water column in there, is responsible for the amount of pressure that we apply, so we can really tailor that to our advantage for what we need. So most of these come in ready-made kits, but it is possible to make our own if we're feeling ambitious and we're really stuck. And then finally, in terms of could there be a role for surgery, very rarely we see cases that require thoracotomy, but they tend to be patients that we've already trying to manage with standard drainage, chest drain placement, and they're just not sealing after several days of good management as we've described. So it's quite rare, but it is something else that we can consider treatment-wise. There isn't really time in this talk today to talk about actually how to place a chest drain itself, but I've put the link here. These are the drains that we're tending to use quite a lot, these Mylar chest drains, and they're placed by a Seldinger technique, so meaning we place them over a wire directly into the pleural space. And there's some really nice videos on this website that can show you how to do it if you're not familiar with them. So useful to have in. The picture on the right shows the drain in a cat. So they're quite small tubes, but for draining air, we don't need anything much bigger. So we can use these same size drains in dogs, and they can be placed under a light sedation, and they're tolerated really very well. So worth considering using if you've not seen these before. And then in the context of pneumothorax, I wanted to mention this study that came out a couple of years ago that intrigued me. So this group reported eight cases where they had patients with persistent pneumothorax for a variety of causes. And they used an autologous blood patch treatment. So what they basically did was they used the patient's own blood to achieve a pleuridesis. So they injected blood, which was acting as something reactive, and that was trying to create a pleuridesis to seal a leak that was causing a persistent pneumothorax in these dogs. So it didn't require any particular extra kit. They took blood straight from the jugular vein. In fact, they took about sort of 5 to 10 mL per kilo of the patient's own blood. and then straight away injected it either via a chest drain or a needle into the pleural space. And interestingly, of these eight dogs, three of them were traumatic pneumothorax in origin. One was a bite wound and two were hit by a car dog. So you could argue that a bite wounds dog with a persistent pneumothorax potentially could have been having a surgical treatment alternatively. But nevertheless, it showed in this study that they did have a decent success rate in terms of having resolution of any persistent pneumothorax. So I'm not sure this procedure would be my first line, but if we've got a tricky patient we don't have other options for, it's definitely something we could consider. I thought I'd mention tension pneumothorax here as our sort of worst case scenario pneumothorax that we see with trauma. So it's quite unusual, but this is different to the standard pneumothorax in that there's probably a valve-like tear either in the pleura or the small airway. So what's happening here is that we've got air leaking out into the pleural space every time that the patient breathes in, but conversely it can't escape with expiration. So we get progressive respiratory distress every single breath, the pneumothorax worsens, the air has nowhere to go. And what we get is a supra atmospheric pressure inside that chest that really compromises ventilation. We can see in this radiograph the lung lobe here has really been compressed to a very small fraction of what it should be. The diaphragm can often be very flattened, and this air just squashes everything and can also compromise venous return, so we can get massive cardiovascular instability too. This is an initial view from a dog that had CT for a pneumothorax, and this was a dog that we drained. We were happy that that we got a significant amount of air out, and we thought we'd just get this quick view of this CT to see if there was an underlying cause. It was a tricky patient to manage, and this dog just filled up within the sort of the couple of minutes it took to get that view, such that this was the remaining lung over here. So tension pneumothorax tends to be very, very severe, severe respiratory compromise, severe cardiovascular compromise, and needs immediate drainage to prevent death, which might otherwise occur within a few minutes. I thought we'd cover pulmonary contusions next, as another common injury, say in blunt trauma, again affecting up to sort of 60% of dogs in one study that's out there. And how do they happen? Well, we get blunt trauma typically to the capillary endothelial cells. And I find like I get caught out by these because they're not always at their worst when the patient initially presents. So typically they'll worsen over the following 24 to 48 hours after the injury. And this is where I feel it's a little bit of a misnomer, because if I hear the word contusion, I think bruise will just get better. But in reality, what we're actually dealing with is pulmonary bleeding, which may well take time to stop and isn't necessarily over immediately. So because these patients can worsen, we have to monitor them, and the presence or the possibility of pulmonary contusions is one of the reasons I might elect to keep a patient in the hospital for monitoring after trauma, even if it initially seems okay. We typically diagnose contusions radiographically, so we see areas of patchy infiltrates, but it's quite typical that the radiographic abnormalities lag behind, so we may underestimate the severity of this condition because we'll get infiltration of inflammatory cells, extra bleeding, and a variety of other pathology sets off after we've had this bleed or this contusion, such that they can get worse and the radiographs don't necessarily show as bad as it might be. A couple of examples of pulmonary contusions here. We've seen this radiograph before in this webinar, and by means of showing the likelihood of multiple injuries, there's a pneumothorax present in this dog as well. So it does raise the point that if we have these contusions that are going to worsen over time, if there is a co-injury that we can treat like a pneumothorax, then it may be worth treating the treatable in a patient who's otherwise unstable. How do we treat pulmonary contusions specifically? Well, annoyingly, we can't. So yes, we can provide oxygen supportively. We can be careful with our fluid therapy. So if the shock cardiovascular instability, we want to restore that perfusion. We don't want to damage other organs as well. But I know if I give too much fluids and they're going to go in the lungs, these contusions are going to get immeasurably worse. So I'll typically use smaller boluses at slower rates and have specific endpoints that aren't too aggressive. I'll also typically go with isotonic crystalloids in preference to colloids or hypertonic saline solutions, just to try and have more of a gentle fluid resuscitation that I can remove maybe if it doesn't do what I want it to, and monitor them very, very closely. Typically, we don't provide antibiotics since it's blood that's leaked out. It's not usually associated with infection, so we typically don't tend to see concurrent pneumonia in these guys as well. Diaphragmatic hernias, it's almost like an innocent bystander in thoracic trauma because they tend to occur if we actually have abdominal pressure, a sudden increase in abdominal pressure when the diaphragm gets forced forward and those anterior organs move with it and through a hole or rent that's made. So in these cases, we may well see thoracic injury if the whole patient's been affected by the trauma, but it's often we'll see injuries caused also, issues with hemabdomen and bladder rupture, orthopedic injuries, and so on. And any organs that go through and make sense, those more cranial in the abdomen to start with are the most likely to be displaced, and it causes our clinical signs, of course, because those organs are compressing the lung. Diagnosis is usually straightforward, so we'll confirm that based on radiographs, but we might have had the heads up from our clinical exam of pleural space disease breathing, and we might have heard gut sounds, or might actually see a fairly empty abdomen on physical exam of this patient. And this is a radiograph that we've probably seen similar cases before. We just don't see a clear outline of the diaphragm at all, and we see abnormal position of the organs in the thoracic cavity. We know these patients are surgical, but the question is how urgent is surgery? And if we have a patient with GI contents that have herniated into the thoracic cavity, especially stomach, then that means it's a surgical emergency to go as soon as possible. Especially since once that stomach has moved, it tends to get distended, and that can really compromise ventilation quite acutely. In rare cases, it's possible that the stomach might become malpositioned, actually torsed in situ in the chest, which is a real problem for obvious reasons. And it is possible in a very unstable patient with a distended stomach to do a gastrocentesis through the thoracic wall to decompress the stomach to get them more stable for anesthesia. But those are quite exciting yet uncommon cases. The other indication for immediate surgery is those where we just can't get them stable with other means as well. Generally speaking, if the patient doesn't fall into those two categories, we'll take them to surgery as soon as they're otherwise stable, and we've assessed all of their other injuries and made sure that there's nothing else we need to address at the same time, so typically within 24 hours. Rib fractures, they can occur with any type of thoracic trauma, and they're the most common type of thoracic injury in people. But in our patients, they rarely occur in isolation. So again, we've seen this radiograph before, and it's just one of several things that's going on. By themselves in our patients, they don't tend to cause an actual problems in themselves. It's more that any pain associated with them can affect the patient's breathing, causing secondary compromise. So if we address the pain, often they become much less clinically relevant to us. We tend to diagnose them radiographically, and they can be easier to see if we invert or rotate the digital films. It just seems like our eyes tune into them a little bit better. And in terms of treating, we said analgesia, so systemic analgesia, but local nerve blocks can be really quite helpful in particularly painful patients or those we don't want to provide too much sort of systemic analgesia to. Patient positioning, potentially a light chest wrap, but it has to be light so as not to compromise breathing, so may not be that effective, and oxygen while things settle down. Where it gets maybe a little bit more questionable is if there's what's called a flail chest present. So we've seen the video of this dog before, but what's happening here is we've got fracture of two or more adjacent rib segments, both dorsally and ventrally, so it's created a little isolated island of rib. And what we see here is that's quite unstable, and causes this paradoxical chest wall movement that we saw before. So patient positioning can be really helpful, having them lying on that side down to minimize abnormal chest wall excursion. And it's rare that surgery is indicated. Usually with supportive care, they tend to do reasonably well. Hemothorax is another possible injury we see with our trauma patients, where we're seeing bleeding into the pleural space from a variety of origins, as I've listed here. But Again, it's a bit of a misnomer because these patients don't usually tend to present with respiratory distress solely due to the pneumothorax. Typically, we'll see cardiovascular compromise and hypovolemic shock due to actual blood loss prior to respiratory signs. Whilst it's a consequence of thoracic trauma, unusually it doesn't tend to cause respiratory signs by itself per se. How do we diagnose it? Well, we do thoracocentesis and we get non-clotting blood back. And in terms of treating it, for the standard hemothorax, what we're doing is treating the hypovolemic shock that's inevitably there and minimizing any other thoracic injuries that may be present. If it's a significant amount of blood, we might need to consider transfusion medicine, giving them new packed red blood cells or fresh whole blood, or potentially auto-transfusing this blood since it should be clean. If it's solely traumatic in origins, that could be something we could consider. And treating any coagulopathy that may be present from just consumption of clotting factors with plasma products or fresh whole blood, again, if indicated. This type of pleural space disease is a little bit unusual for a pleural space disease in that we don't tend to do thoracocentesis unless there's overt respiratory signs, because if we leave those cells, they can potentially be reabsorbed and reutilized by the body at a later date. So we'll tend to leave the fluid there unless it's causing respiratory distress, in which case we'll just take enough to make the patient respiratorily comfortable again. And most of the time, this is usually a self-limiting thing, and if we treat supportively, otherwise they do fine. But if we have uncontrolled bleeding like we would in any other body cavity, we can consider surgery as a treatment of last resort, but it's unusual it gets to that point. Myocardial contusions we can see, so basically bruising or injury to the heart, either because of direct compression or from shear stresses from changes in pressure associated with trauma. And typically these are manifest by cardiac arrhythmias. And again, this may not be as bad as it's going to be initially at the time of the trauma. So typically we'll see them presenting or getting worse between 12 and 48 hours afterwards. And sometimes we just see intermittent VPCs, as we can see on this first ECG trace here. Or we may see more sustained tachycardias, typically ventricular in origin, but may originate from anywhere. So it's something that we can monitor for, and certainly the presence of any irregular pulses or pulse deficits on physical exam would lead us to think that we could look at an ECG to look for the presence of these. And how do we treat them? Well, it would be the same antiarrhythmic treatment we would for an arrhythmia of any other cause, lidocaine being our first choice of ventricular arrhythmias. But we also need to bear in mind that in the average trauma patient, there's lots of other factors that may be potentiating or worsening arrhythmia. So treating any shock that's present, so we're getting good oxygen delivery to the heart and the other tissues, and providing supplemental oxygen to combat any respiratory compromise, minimizing pain, which might otherwise drive arrhythmias, treating anemia with blood products, and making sure that everything else in our blood work is okay, just to provide us a normal environment for that heart to function normally as we possibly can. Coming towards the end, the last few things to mention, a little bit more unusual, but certainly I wanted to mention tracheobronchial injuries, because they're uncommon, but they can be amongst the more life-threatening injuries we see with thoracic trauma. And they're easy to be caught out by because the degree of respiratory distress they present with can be quite variable. So certainly the patient may have had a significant injury, but without obvious leakage or displacement of those normal structures, they may be asymptomatic or just presenting with a cough, or they might have significant emphysema formation with leakage of air. So it can be quite variable. We tend to see on thoracic radiographs, we see evidence of air leakage. And the treatment's variable. If they're very mild, we'll typically cage rest them, but we might need to surgically correct them if there's significant tissue damage. We just need to be prepared that if we do have a trachea that's in two bits, that can provide for quite challenging intubation. So having our people and help around can be quite useful. And to demonstrate some of the more severely affected patients, this radiograph shows some quite impressive subcutaneous emphysema, but also shows the presence of the pneumomediastinum over here. So we can really see a lot more detail in that cranial mediastinum compared to what we would do normally, consistent with air leakage in that compartment. And this view shows a similar thing. Again, we're seeing a lot more detail in that cranial mediastinum. We can actually see the cranial vena cava coming here that we shouldn't do normally. But the actual trachea itself, we're seeing a loss of continuity of that tracheal wall. And what's termed a tracheal stripe sign down here, we're actually seeing the wall of the trachea outlined by gas on either side, which is consistent with airway rupture. High-risk syndrome, more so related to CATS, having a fall from a significant height, and the injuries that we tend to see most commonly that need to be on our radar are pneumothorax and pulmonary contusions, but we can also see the classic orthopedic and oral injuries as well. And so we would treat those as we would for any of the things that we've discussed at this point. And the very final thing I wanted to mention and discuss a little bit more was the penetrating wounds specifically. So as we mentioned, these are things like bite wounds and so on that can cause any of the injuries that we've talked about so far, but do get handled a little bit differently in that the tendency is that more often than not, they may well need surgical exploration once they're stable. If something has a wound on the outside or the potential it's had a penetrating wound, then this is where our radiographs are very useful to look for pneumothorax or any other sign that there's been communication between the thorax and the outside world. And we need careful wound management of anything that's there. So typically we'll just sterilely lubricate these wounds and cover them over to prevent hospital-acquired infections and further contamination until we can deal with them later. The sort of internal injuries that we might see and might have to deal with at surgery are really going to vary depending on the cause. So with gunshot wounds, if we have our air gun pellets, oftentimes they go in, we leave them in there. They don't cause extensive injury, but with some of the more concerning weapons out there, we can see extensive tissue injury with hemorrhage and crush injuries, laceration of surrounding structures, and certainly exit wounds that can be worse than entrance wounds. So depends on what we're up against as to what we can expect to find at surgery. And finally, a mention to bite wounds. I think these are probably some of the more common penetrating wounds that I see in my clinic at the moment. So these might be big dog, little dog, bite wounds where the small patient's been picked up and shaken. So we've got penetrating wounds, but also shear and crush injuries, or dog versus cat, certainly. Again, a sort of a mismatch of size. And with those, it's definitely the case that what we see on the outside often isn't reflective of what we see under the surface. And because of that shaking, that shear stress, we can often have significant areas of devitalized tissue under an otherwise fairly normal looking skin, and similarly within the thoracic cavity we can see significant injuries. So bite wounds can't be, wounds can carry through with them lots of fur and environmental contamination, so there can be a lot of cleanup to do as well. So these cases can often require emergency surgery to assess the extent of the injuries fairly early on. A lot of them can be very systemically affected, and the systemic inflammation and infection can be something that can really contribute to a high mortality and morbidity in these patients. But simple things that we can do to try and minimize that would be early antibiotic therapy, and certainly thinking about sepsis generally. One of the biggest things at the moment that's shown to improve outcome in sepsis is early targeted antibiotic therapy, which for bite wounds is something that we could easily prioritize, even if it's going to be difficult to fix the mess that might be contained inside later. And so I guess the key points from today is things like that we know that trauma can be blunt or penetrating in origin, and that there's a whole host of injuries that can be present, of which it's common to have more than one. But hopefully if we apply a nice, calm, logical approach, stabilize as much as we can, and then we know what to do to provide them definitive diagnosis, we should hopefully have good outcomes for these patients. So with that, I don't know if anybody has any questions they'd like to ask. So the question that we've got coming in is there anything with the pulmonary contusions, is there anything that we can do to treat them if we're saying that there's they just sort of get worse before they get better? And unfortunately not. People have suggested all sorts of things historically. So people have commonly used antibiotics, people have commonly used furosemide. And I guess with the antibiotics, people have felt strongly that because blood can be a good culture medium, that they may be indicated, but there's actually no evidence to say that they help but might create resistant infections. So I'm still not sold on antibiotics being indicated. Furosemide itself probably isn't going to be terribly useful because the leakage has already occurred. It's not that we're dealing with a high pressure system that we're trying to take the edge off with a heart failure patient. So furosemide itself probably isn't going to be that useful either, but may worsen cardiovascular stability. So I think it probably comes down to just trying to get them through it. And things that we can do to maybe help with that is just, I think, very careful fluid therapy. So I'll try and keep them on the drier side, certainly being very conservative with my fluid therapy. And if they're drinking, I'm much happier for them to manage their own fluid balance. I feel like it's less likely I'm going to overload them if they're drinking as opposed to me giving fluids. I think the really tricky cases are the ones where they're particularly sick, but they're just at the point where they might not make it that couple of days to get better. And if referral or ventilation isn't an option, as is the case for most of these, sadly, there are things that we can do to try and decrease their work of breathing. So drugs like aminophylline or actually intravenous caffeine we can administer just to try and give their breathing a little bit more energy to get them through it, minimizing stress and treating any concurrent injuries that that might be present. So not a whole host that we can do, but maybe some things that might save the odd patient potentially. Hopefully that helps. Okay, well, if there's no more questions, I just want to say thank you for listening, and hopefully that was useful.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Lindsay for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.